Welcome, everybody, to the Across the Sky podcast, our Lee Enterprises national weather podcast brought to you all across the country. And it's brought to you by our team of meteorologists here at Lee Enterprise. I'm Joe Martucci, meteorologist for the Press of Atlantic City. Joined with me this week, Kirsten Lang at the Tulsa World and Matt Hollander, our workhorse out in the Midwest over in Chicagoland. Sean Sublett from the Richmond Times-Dispatch could not be here this episode. He is out for a National Weather Association board meeting, so that's really exciting for him. He'll be back with us next week. Guys, we are wrapping up February, and, you know, I was texting my sister this morning, and she was saying, you know, I would just like one snowstorm, in New Jersey, and then get to spring. And I said, you know, I usually agree with you, but this year for me, I'm kind of just ready to move on to the 60s and 70s because it's just been mild and we haven't seen anything. Matt, you over in Chicagoland, though, have seen all kinds of wintry weather this winter, including today on Thursday when we're recording. So what's going on out by you?
Yeah, just call me Mr. Winter Storm because, I mean, it's a weekly basis. I mean, literally the last 3 weeks, a system has tracked across the Midwest. Slightly different impacts each time, depending on the location. But the Midwest has been impacted, some getting in on severe storms, some getting in on heavy snow, and I mean a lot of snow, and others getting in the lovely wintry mix where you start with rain and then it goes to freezing rain and then sleet and then snow, or maybe you start as snow and go the opposite. That's happened too. So constant things to update folks on, but I'm at the opposite of you where like I'm ready for spring just because I'm so over the snow and these winter storms. You know, at first it's like everyone I think has that excitement early on in the season. A big winter storm comes in, it's like, oh boy, look at all the snow. But after a while, especially places like Wisconsin that have just been slammed again and again, it's like, okay, this is enough now. Even if you love snow, I feel like there's a limit. And I think even those snow lovers are starting to hit that limit.
Yeah, we had a winter like that, and our guests might be able to remind me, but I think it was 2014-15 where it just kept snowing and snowing and snowing. I'm like, you know what? At some point, like, yeah, I'm just ready for like even 50 degrees at that point. We'll take it on down south to Kirsten. I think you guys were pretty cold recently, if not today, right?
You know, it's been back and forth, and really overall, it's been pretty mild. I mean, we've had a couple of like cold spouts here and there. Today's chilly, you know, the high is like 45 or something like that. But yesterday it was, you know, near 70 degrees and sunny and beautiful. And then it'll be 70 degrees again on Sunday. So they're quick little snippets. We are below average on snowfall, which is not, I mean, a huge deal for Tulsa or anything like that. But, you know, we are a little below average for snowfall. But then again, the temperatures, like I was mentioning, I was trying to pull up my email here, but I believe we are on track for the 27th warmest winter on record. But, you know, it's one of those things where, I don't know. I think at this point, now that we're kind of making our way into March, it's just like, well, might as well just be spring. You know what I mean? I mean, if there was another like cold, you know, spout with snow, I think it's just, I don't know. It's just been like lingering. It's just kind of like, all right, well, let's just get on with it and move to the next season. So that's how I feel at least.
So I think we're on the same page with this one. I have a non-weather question for you, Kirsten. I know Bruce Springsteen just came to Tulsa a couple days ago. Now Bruce Springsteen is like a whole nother level out here in Jersey. So three questions. One, did you go? Two, do you know anybody that did go if you didn't go? And three, what is Bach? Because that's where they played at the Bach.
Yeah. Okay. So no, I did not go. Yes, I do have friends that did go. And it's actually BOK, which stands for Bank of Oklahoma.
Okay.
Yeah. BOK Center is kind of our big event center where anytime we have any, you know, Bruce Springsteen or Justin Bieber, you know, kind of caliber performers come through, that's where they play.
How did your friends like the show?
I haven't talked to them, but they had some nice pictures, so I'm assuming they enjoyed it.
So he's playing 2 days here in New Jersey. Of course, Bruce Springsteen, born and raised in New Jersey. And like, this is going to turn into a Taylor Swift situation with Ticketmaster because we had to do the verified fans. And then like my friend put his 3 phone numbers. He got them. I didn't get them. My wife got them. It's like, who did, who didn't? And I'm afraid to see what the ticket prices are going to be when they go on sale on Friday. I might update you guys next week because we're going to see if we're going to go.
So fun.
Getting back to weather. Something we wanted to do for a while is talk about forensic meteorology. And really, you know, we always like to talk about things outside of what we're doing in media. When it comes to meteorology, forensics is it's a whole business. There are businesses built on it, including the one that our guest works for as well. We used to work together, of course. Sherilyn Patrick, she is the director of forensic services for WeatherWorks, which is a meteorological consulting firm in New Jersey. Sherilyn has been with WeatherWorks since 2014. So she's been here. She's been there for a while, really involved with, court cases and lawsuits and lawyers and all that stuff. And as Sherilyn reminded me, I used to sell her textbooks at Rutgers. I forgot about that, Sherilyn. So thank you for telling me that.
That's right, Joe.
But thanks for coming on, Sherilyn. We appreciate it.
Of course. Very happy to be here. Excited.
Yeah. My first question, and we'll talk a little bit about you and your interest in weather, but explain to people, like, can you give an elevator pitch of what forensic meteorology is?
Yeah. So the best way to explain forensic meteorology is that it's a past weather reconstruction. So we're so used to thinking like, oh, meteorology, weather, like it's forecasts, it's people on TV, it's maybe the National Weather Service or a private weather consulting company. But it's not just always about like the present and the future. Oftentimes you need to look into the past, especially in the case of maybe a personal injury lawsuit or a property damage claim, and essentially reconstruct the weather that would have happened at that date, time, and location.
Got it. And, like I was saying at the top, there are businesses built on forensic meteorology. WeatherWorks, I don't know how much you can say or can't say, but like what part of the business is actually forensic meteorology?
Right. So at least at our company, because we're multifaceted, we do forecasts. We have other kind of past weather resources as it relates to climatology and especially snow climatology. Currently, our forensic meteorology department makes up probably about like 10% of our company, but it definitely has its own department, its own full staff. There's about four or five of us dedicated toward essentially forensic meteorology. And there's four of us as experts. So obviously the owner of the company, Frank Lombardo, he was kind of the OG, the original forensic meteorologist back in the 80s. And then back in the 90s, when he hired Thomas Else, he's our senior forensic meteorologist. He's been in the business for 25 years. Frank is going on 35, 40, I think. And then there's myself as director of the department. And we also have Zachary Chabala, who's about 5 years experience at this point. So there's a good number of us.
Awesome. And let's just talk about, your interest in weather. When did you know that forensic meteorology was, a career path? And then how did you get interested in weather? Because I don't even know that.
I guess we'll go from the very beginning of how I personally got into weather. So Kirsten may know this, but what springed my interest was back in 1999, there was the Oklahoma tornado outbreak. 2000, Discovery Channel was already putting out documentaries regarding it. And I was just fascinated, like glued to the television. I couldn't stop watching tornado docuseries. So any chance I could, I'd watch them. And then Floyd actually happened in our area, I believe in 2001.
99.
All right. Yeah. So Floyd must have happened around the same time as or shortly after the Oklahoma tornado outbreak. Yeah. So between the tornadoes and the hurricanes, destructive weather was essentially my thing. So that's how I got looped into it. In my early days when I was about 7 or 8 years old. And then eventually in terms of the forensic meteorology, I didn't learn about it until I was already a senior in college. It was actually at the American Meteorological Society. They had a forensic meteorology seminar where they kind of talked to a bunch of different forensic meteorologists, told us what it was and how it works. And I thought, wow, I like this. I'd rather focus on the past rather than the future. So that's where it kind of sprung my interest. WeatherWorks had it. So once I got my job at WeatherWorks, I kind of hit the ground running in forensic meteorology as I also learned how to forecast and work in the operational department.
So since I'm on the forecasting side of things, I'm familiar with the tools used to make a forecast, but what tools do you use when you're looking at the past? What resources are you using to look up past weather information?
So forecasting uses a lot of model data, but you also need to be aware of current conditions. So we use a lot of ground truth observations, right? Like METAR sites, maybe, you know, if it's like early in the morning and the co-op and the COCAROS observations, those daily precipitation observations are in. We utilize those in forensic meteorology. And then we also take into consideration any kind of National Weather Service products that were put out. So forecasts, watches, warnings, advisories, special weather statements. And then, of course, another powerful resource that we need for both forecasting and forensic meteorology is radar. Being able to get down to, you know, as close of a resolution as you can for your client. So really a whole source of resources that you need to use for past weather, that, you know, for the most part is readily available.
And Sherilyn, you know, I was going to ask too, how accurate are the reports that are given out by forensic meteorologists? Cause I did read that they were actually more, accurate than weather forecasts themselves. Can you explain why that would be?
Correct. So the best way to explain it is that it already happened, right? A forecast is trying to predict what's going to happen a couple hours to a couple days in advance. Whereas, you know, a lot of times we're doing forensic meteorology reports for accidents that occurred 2 or 3 years ago or more, or a little bit less. The data is there. There is that ground truth observation data that we can go in and observe. And because we're using numerous networks, we're using radar data, we're referencing National Weather Service products, and you actually have, you know, a meteorologist who is familiar with the weather patterns. All of us that are forensic meteorologists, we're trained and have done forecasting operations. So we kind of know how storms generally go, and how the data tends to be reported because we're used to doing it real time, that we are able to analyze and interpolate that past data to make a site-specific report specific to a certain date, time, and location.
And you're going to lead me into my next question here. I was going to kind of play devil's advocate because sometimes people say, well, you know, why do I need to hire somebody to look at stuff that happened in the past? I can just go on weather.gov and find what happened at the local airport or something. Why does site-specific matter? And is it possible to give us like an example maybe of some, you know, work you've done in the past where it does actually make a real difference?
The most resolute data that you can get, at least in terms of being able to understand what you're looking at as a layperson, is from airport data. So it's also referred to as METAR or F6 or ASOS or AWOS. Many different terms for it. It's virtually the same thing. A lot of it is decoded and you can Google it. You could look at weather, past weather from Newark or maybe Philadelphia Airport, particularly in a lot of major cities and even kind of some smaller localities. But unfortunately, this data is not everywhere. You know, you could be working on a case where the closest airport is 30 miles away. And you guys all know that 30 miles is a big difference when it comes to severe weather or wintry storms. So that is why people would hire a forensic meteorologist, is unless like an incident happened directly at the airport. And even then you may need to be careful. We have had incidents like that happen before where we're doing a report where the reporting station is on one side of the airport and maybe the accident happened on the other side of the airport and there's a little bit of a weather difference. But a lot of the times, you know, let's just take Newark, for example. You can't use Newark Airport for Hackettstown, New Jersey. That's on the northwestern section of the state. The weather could be very different, and it can make or break your case. You know, it may be 31, 32 degrees in Hackettstown with black ice, but Newark's been reporting 35 degrees in rain. So it really is valuable for attorneys and insurance adjusters to hire people like us to get that site-specific, to analyze all the weather data, not just the nearest airport.
Awesome stuff, Sherilyn. Well, we definitely got more questions for you, but we did want to take a brief break. We'll come back. We'll talk to you more about forensic meteorology. We're talking to Sherilyn Patrick, the Director of Forensic Meteorology at WeatherWorks, and you're listening to the Across the Sky podcast. Welcome back, everybody, to the Across the Sky podcast brought to you by Lee Enterprises. Meteorologist Joe Martucci here. We have Kirsten Lang. We have Matt Polliner. We have meteorologist Sherilyn Patrick. She's the Director of Forensic Services at WeatherWorks in Hackettstown, New Jersey here. And make sure too, you can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, and new episodes come out every Monday, usually at night, usually every Monday night. You can definitely find it on Mondays wherever you get your podcast. All right. So Sherilyn, back to forensic meteorology. So someone calls you, they said they need, you know, weather information for a court case. I know it's going to vary, but like in general, you know, how long does it actually take to do this? And, you know, what's the process? Like, what is it like to actually sit there and actually go through this data?
Yeah, of course. So usually if somebody calls us or makes a request for a forensic report, I mean, we can do anything from just doing an objective weather analysis where we just say, hey, here are the weather conditions and the days leading up to and including the date time of incident at this particular location, to as far as reviewing any kind of discovery. So discovery usually includes like documentation relating to the incident in question, maybe a complaint. There's a document called interrogatories, which is just questions about what happened that the plaintiff or the claimant has to answer. Depositions. So oftentimes the attorneys will depose both sides, the plaintiffs and the defendants, to figure out, you know, how much do they know or remember of the actual incident, to try and get those facts on paper as if it's, you know, essentially under oath. So we can review those. We review any photographs. It's especially nice if they have photographs right after the incident occurred. And sometimes we even get surveillance video that we can review. So in those cases, if we just do like an objective analysis, we're not reviewing any kind of case discovery, we're just looking at the weather conditions and reconstructing, those take about 2 to 4 hours worth of research. And then, of course, if we're reviewing discovery and maybe coming up with extra conclusions, those are on the order of 4 to 7 hours worth of research or higher, depending. But at least in terms of the stages of what we do is that we plot the incident location on Google Earth. We kind of get a feel of all the weather stations. We like to do a cross section, so north, south, east, and west of all the weather stations around that kind of incident location. And then we collect that data. So maybe it's airport, maybe it's daily precipitation observations, those co-ops and COCOs, any kind of National Weather Service products that were issued during that time, and then also radar. And we'll take all that data, we'll review it, we'll summarize it, and essentially use our expertise as meteorologists, knowing essentially how storms work and the natural climate of the given area, and create that kind of site-specific weather report that's specific to that date, time, and location, and tailored to the incident in question.
Now, do you and your team ever actually go into court, or do you just supply these written reports, or is there ever any oral component to this where you're actually brought into the courtroom to testify, or is it just a report that you're giving to the lawyers or to the judges or whoever is looking for that information?
Right. So we actually work as expert witnesses, they're called. So not only do we do the reports, but we can be called to testify. So sometimes it can be in the form of where the court case is happening and then we're put on the stand in front of judge and jury and we're getting cross-examined by the attorneys. Other times there's another form called depositions, which I mentioned before. So we as expert witnesses can be called and deposed to talk about the report that we created. So those can be interesting. I haven't actually testified in court before, but I have been deposed twice before. You know, and one of the cases I actually got deposed on, that was a tough one. I was deposed for about 3 hours. I was representing one of the defendants, and there actually can be multiple defendants. So I had two other defense attorneys that were essentially on my side. And then I was being cross-examined by the plaintiff's attorney. And it wound up being a little bit of a difficult case. This was an incident where somebody slipped and fell outside of a Domino's. They were going to pick up pizza after work, and then they slipped and fell. And the contention was this old snow and ice that this person slipped and fell on, and therefore the defendants were liable, aka they should have removed and remediated the snow and ice there. And actually caused, you know, a liability concern, or was it an ongoing storm? And if that's the case, there usually is favor on the defendant's side, because there's only so much that you can do if snow is actively falling, particularly if it's heavy. So this particular slip and fall happened at the tail end of a snowstorm where it was just tapering out. And they can be very strict on is it precipitating or not to determine is it storm in progress. Because if it's storm in progress, great, that's favorable for the defendants. But if you can prove that there wasn't a storm in progress, then that's a little bit more favorable for the plaintiffs. So I was being grilled by the plaintiff attorney to try and show, was it actually snowing at that time? Because my report said, yes, it was. And I had to go through all the different data sources I utilized. I had to go through radar to essentially build that case for my client, which was the defendants.
Okay, Sherilyn, so I'm not sure if I heard this correctly, but a couple of things. First, did you say that you actually will recreate, like do you actually recreate the situation physically at times, or did you just mean that you recreate it in the fact that you compile enough past data to try to figure out what actually happened?
Yeah, the latter. Sometimes we have worked with other experts who can actually kind of like physically recreate what conditions would have been. Those are particularly useful in like lighting cases where somebody can actually mimic, you know, what it looked like at that particular time and location in terms of what the plaintiff would have seen. But most of the times, yeah, we're using tables and charts and maybe radar images to try and come up with here's what other conditions were.
And then the other question I have too with this is, are a lot of these cases that you get, are they somewhat local to where you're located, or are they just pretty much anywhere across the country?
At least what our company does is that we can do nationwide. So as long as it's in the US or US territory where we can use NOAA data, it's free game and anybody can retain us and hire us. But it tends to be easier on the sense of our clients if we are local, especially if we need to testify. So I would say majority of our cases are in New Jersey, New York, and PA. But like I said, nationwide, we actually had one of our experts a couple months ago. We flew him out to the middle of nowhere, Washington State, to testify on a court case, you know, so we've done it all. We can go anywhere.
As a just a funny question, has anyone ever called you outside of the U.S. looking for a forensic report?
They have. We do occasionally get people inquiring from Canada, and we prefer to kind of stay away from it just because a lot of the certifications, you don't necessarily need like an American Meteorological Society certified consulting meteorologist certification to testify, but Canada does have their own version of that, and we would be more comfortable having that certification there. I've gotten requests for, you know, the Virgin Islands, not necessarily the U.S. I think we got a request for like an army base in Korea. We've gotten requests for in Europe. So technically we could do them, but we prefer to stay away from them unless we have that particular jurisdiction certification. Certainly has more weight when it comes to testifying.
And we talked about locations of where you covered, but I'm also curious about when. What's the farthest back y'all have looked back at an event, whether you or someone on your team? How far back can you go, and what's the farthest back you have gone?
We can go as far back as the weather data is available. Right now, it tends to be quote-unquote easier for us to go back to, let's say, the early to mid-2000s because of the way the METAR data is structured. That kind of airport data is easily readable. But technically, we can go as far back as we need to. I think the oldest that we did was actually my boss, Frank, well before I even started at the company. He did, I believe, a case from back in the 60s. I'm trying to remember what exactly it was, but it had to do with Death Valley. And I think it resulted in somebody, you know, they got lost in Death Valley and eventually succumbed to dehydration and heat exhaustion, and we had to reconstruct the weather for out there.
So Sherilyn, just one more quick question from me, and you kind of touched on this just a bit, but you know, I guess for meteorologists that may just be getting out of school, starting their career, and think that this kind of sounds, you know, something that's of interest to them, could you answer the question of whether or not just any degreed meteorologist can be a forensic meteorologist, or there are certain certifications? I noticed you mentioned a couple of those. And then also, it sounds too like, and I know you've been doing this for a little while, but it sounds like you have a pretty good kind of law background. Is that anything that you need as well to be a forensic meteorologist?
So in terms of a law background, you don't necessarily need one. At a minimum, to become a forensic meteorologist, you just need a bachelor's in meteorology or atmospheric science. I did mention a certification before. It's through the American Meteorological Society, the Certified Consulting Meteorologist. You usually don't obtain that until you've been working as a forensic meteorologist for a while and you've worked on a number of cases, you've gone to trial, you've been deposed, and usually they recommend at least 5 or 10 years experience before you go for that certification. You need to provide references, you have to take a written test, then you have to take an oral test. So it's very rigorous, and that's why they require you to work in the field for a certain amount of time before you go take it. But once you do get that certification, it does give you that extra boost in terms of credibility as working as an expert witness in the forensic meteorology world. But people just starting out, you know, those of you that are in college that may be interested in pursuing forensic meteorology, certainly be sure to be members of the American Meteorological Society and the National Weather Association. And then also be sure to brush up on your METAR. Very important in this world. And, you know, just continually ask questions. You know, maybe you want to work for a private weather firm and do this. Find private weather firms that do forensic meteorology. Work underneath another forensic meteorologist. Maybe find some case studies. You can easily Google and find plenty of meteorological firms that have, like, essentially case studies, cases they've worked on, cases they've won with. So it's always good to do your research, because research and investigation is part of the forensic meteorology process.
You said really know your METAR, Sherilyn. I know you know, because we worked at WeatherWorks, and, you know, but Rob Real, who's also at WeatherWorks, grilling me on METARs for like days and days and days, and knowing every single code in there. So I am like good with METARs after that. It's like a Tough Mudder, you know, type of session with METARs. But my last question for you, and then we'll wrap up, is what is your favorite part? What do you enjoy most about, you know, working on these reports when it comes to forensic meteorology?
I think my favorite thing is finding the truth. You often see with these court cases, especially if you get the discovery and you're reading through depositions, is a lot of the times, and it's called statute of limitations, people have up to 2 or 3 years, depending on the jurisdiction, to actually file a court case on maybe a personal injury or a property damage claim. And actually get it through the court process. And then once you file it, it could take another 2 or 3 years for it to go through the process of either settling, AKA it doesn't go to trial, but somebody pays out money to the plaintiff or the claimant, or maybe it does go to court. So you're talking about years after the accident happened and different people giving their recollection of what happened from a couple years ago on a certain date, time, or location. So details can get fuzzy. Somebody may say that it was snowing out. And then you look at the weather data and you're like, man, no way was it snowing at that particular time, date, and location. So kind of being able to put the pieces together and say within a scientific and meteorological certainty that this is what happened is really the most satisfying part and the most interesting part for me.
Awesome. Well, great, Sherilyn. That was wonderful. And we appreciate you coming on and talking to us about this subset of meteorology that is really interesting. It's like detective work. And it's great we had you come on and share your expertise. Anything else you want to say before we really wrap on up and we'll get to our outro here?
No, nothing else. I mean, if anybody does need a, you know, certified past weather report, always feel free to hit us up at WeatherWorks. Again, we're based out of Hackettstown, New Jersey, and you can find more information at www.certifiedpastweatherreport.com.
Awesome. Sherilyn, thank you again for coming on. Really appreciate it. We're going to do our astronomy report with Tony Rice, and we'll be back with you after the break. We'll recap and tell you what's coming next on the Across the Sky Pod.
Looking beyond the atmosphere, here's Tony Rice with your astronomy outlook.
Venus and Jupiter finally come together this week in the evening sky. We've been watching them throughout February get closer and closer, and on Wednesday evening, March 1st, look to the west after dark for two bright points of light. On the left is Jupiter, and on the right is Venus. And they're about half a degree apart. Also try stretching out your hand and put your pinky between them. That's about a degree wide. Both are bright and very easy to spot because they're both covered in highly reflective clouds. Though you could fit about 1,400 Venuses in a Jupiter, it's a lot farther away, so Venus is still about 6 or 7 times brighter than Jupiter. And that's something that really becomes apparent when they're this close together. Elsewhere in the sky, look for the waxing crescent moon to pass within a degree of Mars on Monday evening. Look nearly overhead for the sliver of moon next to orangey Mars. That's your Astronomy Outlook. Follow me at RTP Hokie for more spacey stuff like this.
Well, we thank Sharon again for coming on the Across the Sky podcast. You know, Matt, I think you said it best in the break. You know, we're kind of hitting on like all sectors of meteorology in the past couple of weeks. And that's good. You know, that's kind of our role working in media to bring other people's stories to light. But yeah, we've kind of been going all around the weather world recently.
Yeah, trying to show people all the different aspects of meteorology and how meteorology is involved in so many different things. I mean, when you get into forensics, and you know, one of the things she mentioned during the break that I think is worth sharing with our listeners here is that they have just at their firm 500 to 700 cases a year, and that's just one place. And you know, there are other firms doing this, and so think of all the court cases and lawsuits where weather is involved, and that number starts to get big. And I'm guessing that it's probably gone up, you know, in the last 10 years or so with all the additional extreme weather that we've been seeing. I mean, it does add up, and you realize how many people are impacted. You know, a lot, you know, if you're not directly impacted, you see the headlines and then move on. But for those people that are directly impacted, I mean, they deal with the impacts, especially when it's a significant event like a hurricane, for example, for years, and it stays in the court system for years. And folks like Sherilyn are dealing with it years after an event happened. So it's very fascinating, interesting conversation.
Yeah, it's something you don't, even as a meteorologist, sometimes you forget that that's a it's a necessity whenever you have the types of court cases that come out. But yeah, I'm with you, Matt. I think it was very interesting listening to her talk about that particular sector of our field.
Especially because we're on a daily basis so focused on what's coming, and then like stop and like, wait a minute, let's go back. And especially not just a couple days back. Sometimes, you know, it's worth looking at, oh, this is what happened yesterday. You know, we do that in the broadcast sector a lot, but we're talking about going back months, years of what happened and really diving into a situation and getting into the meteorology, like why did this happen? You know, I think that would be interesting too. Not only what happened, but why did it play out this way? I mean, it kind of leads, I think when you go back and dissect these events, it leads to a better understanding of meteorology too. You can learn from the past for the next storm that has a similar setup. You can learn from the past to apply it to the future to make better forecasts. So I think there's a lot of value in looking back in the past. I think sometimes we get so caught up in what's next. Like it's actually worthwhile to go and look in the past. So I think it's fascinating to see a whole group of meteorologists where that's what they do is look at the past.
Yeah. And, it's also, looking back, and I've done a couple of these forensic reports, it's kind of like refreshing because you're always like thinking about, oh my gosh, I got to like wait a day or 2 days and like make sure that the forecast verified. But like with the forensic report, like, you don't think about that because it's in the past. So it's a different kind of mindset. It's at least it was refreshing to me, a couple of times that I've done them. But we'll wrap it up for this episode of the Across the Sky podcast. Make sure you can subscribe wherever you get your podcast. We're just about everywhere here. Coming up, we have a couple of guests coming up, a couple of different topics. We're going to be talking about the National Severe Storms Laboratory out in Oklahoma. We're going to be talking about spring green up. And if you're in the eastern half of the United States, you might already be seeing that in February, depending on where you are. And we're also going to have Liz Lightman on in the next couple of weeks. She actually made history as the first woman to issue a Storm Prediction Center convective watch just earlier this month. So we're really happy to have, all these different topics and guests on. If you have an idea for a topic or a guest, give us a shout. We're all easy enough to find on social media. So you can give us a shout there. But until next Monday, everybody. I'm meteorologist Joe Martucci on behalf of Matt Hollander, Kirsten Lang, and Sean Sutler. And we are the Across the Sky podcast. Talk to you soon.